You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome back to another episode of the City of Man podcast, a show which tries to talk about politics and political theory from the vantage of traditional Christian conviction. I am Edward Song, an associate professor of philosophy at Westmont College in Santa Barbara, California, and with me, as always, is Coyle Neal, assistant professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Coyle, how's it going today?
It's going well. How are you, Ed?
I am doing pretty well. I know that we recently received some corrections from some people in the Christian Humanist podcast family, so why don't we go ahead and start with that?
Yeah, so I got a note from one of our Christian Humanist overlords. Michael Farmer notified me that, in fact, academics do read Neil Gaiman and H.P. Lovecraft. So a few episodes back, was it our second episode or third episode? I mean, it was one of the early ones. I had said I struggled to see English professors sitting around and enjoying sort of the pulp fiction. Apparently, I am just wrong about that, and I think that might even be a direct quote from Michael Farmer. And in fairness, the number of English literature studies folks that I know well enough to know what they read for leisure is pretty small, so I am happy to accept that correction. I'm still going to sort of picture them holding scented handkerchiefs over their noses while they read this stuff, but maybe I'm wrong about that too. Maybe
there's I know lots of professors of various different stripes and various different disciplines who very much enjoy pulpy stuff.
I do. But the folks that I know who tend to enjoy it tend to be scientists, so chemists and physicists and those sorts of people, or historians.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I just sort of built a mental wall around the lit people, and I am wrong about that and happy to say that I am. So that's one correction from Michael Farmer. The second correction comes from Alexis Neal, who you probably recognize the name from the Christian Feminist podcast, or just because she's married to me. In the last episode, I had said that she was the president of CLS at Ohio State when one of the issues that we were talking about last time was going on. I had said that was one of the first cases where you have sort of this conflict between religious freedom and the various rights of other groups, homosexuals and transgendered individuals and so on. The correction that's needed there is that was not the first case. It was a very early case, but it was not the first of them. So we'll throw up a link. We have a list of the number of cases that have gone on at schools in the country. We'll throw that up on the website, and you can see just how wrong I was. So those are the corrections we've got.
Duly noted. In our last podcast, well, we're calling this podcast Bathrooms and Wedding Cakes Part 2. In Bathrooms and Wedding Cakes Part 1, Coyle and I talked about the controversies that have unfolded in North Carolina over the past few months. You'll remember that those controversies were engendered when the city of Charlotte, North Carolina, passed a local ordinance prohibiting discrimination against gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender persons in public settings. Within 24 hours of them passing that ordinance, it was quickly superseded by a House bill which effectively abolished the aims of the Charlotte City Council. So the new statewide bill, HB 2, did two main things. It made it illegal for transgender persons to use anything but the bathrooms that coincided with the gender on their birth certificate. And the second thing that it did is that it also made it legal for businesses, restaurants, or other public accommodations to refuse service to LGBTQ persons. And so we talked at length in that last show about the bathroom part of the bill, but we never got around to really talking about the issues of religious liberty that arose in that second part of the bill. So that's the wedding cakes part of the title of these episodes, and we're calling it that because while I don't think there were specific issues involving Christian bakers refusing service to gay couples in North Carolina, they have clearly occurred in other parts of the country, And the North Carolina law is at least in part trying to address some of these worries about religious liberties. So Coyle, can you remind us of what some of these other cases have looked like?
Yeah, and I'm glad you made that distinction, Ed, because these are not the same issue, other than this North Carolina law deals with both of them.
Yep.
Right, so if it weren't for this North Carolina law, we would be able to just totally separate these things, especially given we also talked about the letter from Obama or the letter from the Department of Justice last time, mm-hmm. Where he said, public schools have to allow transgendered students to use the bathroom of their choice, or else they're going to come along and take lunch money away from poor kids. So that is not the same thing as you have to, bake a cake for a homosexual couple getting married. And they are just different aspects, not even different aspects of the same thing. They are largely different issues, especially since this homosexual marriage thing has been going on longer. There are any number of examples that we could look at. These go way back. Way back, I mean that as if I were talking to a student to whom 2005 is they were four or whatever. A t-shirt company in Kentucky refused to make custom shirts for a gay pride festival. That was one of the earliest of these cases. A Colorado baker was ordered to provide wedding cakes for homosexual weddings or be fined by the state. In 2007, there was a New Mexico wedding photographer who refused to photograph a gay wedding. That case ended up in the New Mexico Supreme Court and eventually ended up almost to the U.S. Supreme Court, where the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court, did not overturn the state Supreme Court's findings. And a Washington florist had refused to provide floral arrangements for a gay wedding. And the big case that everyone's been watching more recently has come in Oregon. So just a little bit of background on that. In Oregon, this bakery had refused to make cakes for a homosexual wedding. We should note that this wedding was taking place before gay marriage was legal in Oregon. So this was originally in 2013. This was before Obergefell v. Hodges. This was before it had passed in the state. This homosexual couple filed a complaint. It's not exactly the same thing as suing, but it's very similar. So they filed a complaint with the government of Oregon. Oregon's Bureau of Labor and Industries ordered the bakery to pay $135,000 for emotional damages, which obviously no small business can afford that sort of thing. So the government went in and seized their assets. The state government of Oregon seized their assets. This couple who owned the bakery then raised money around the country to pay this fine. And then sued the government, and it's now working its way through the courts, which is sort of where we're at now. It is heading towards the courts. A number of major names have gotten involved with this case. Mm-hmm. There's a former American ambassador who'd been a law clerk for Earl Warren who's taken on the case on the side of the bakery, who's going to be defending them. Again, everyone's sort of watching to see what happens. We have not yet completely resolved this issue. A few things.
Yeah, that case is working its way through. The Colorado cake involving Masterpiece Cake Shop is also working its way through the system. I guess in both cases, the state Supreme Courts ruled against the bakeries, and they've appealed it up to the next level.
Yeah, I don't know. I know that it is heading to the where do I have this written down here? It is going to the – eventually their goal is the U.S. Supreme Court, but
yeah.
The next stage, according to – this is the Oregon Court of Appeals. And I don't know Oregon's court system. That could mean their state Supreme Court, or it could just be at a level beneath their state.
Yeah.
I don't actually
– I know that the Colorado Supreme Court ruled on that Colorado case.
Right. They do have a decision there. What will probably happen if this does make it to the Supreme Court level is you'll see all of these cases sort of bundled together. They always do it that way rather than
like in the Little Sisters of Charity case.
Right. Which we also saw recently, although again that's a slightly different issue.
Yeah.
Can I
chip in one point, maybe you were going to get to this. But there were these other earlier cases, so like back in 2007 there was a New Mexico wedding photographer who refused to photograph a gay wedding.
Right.
And she was sued. the New Mexico Supreme Court ruled against her. And then she appealed up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court declined to even hear her case.
Right. So the state Supreme Court decision stands.
Yeah, that's right. The one interesting thing about that case is that this Christian photographer in that case wasn't citing reasons of religious liberty to right. defend her actions. She was sort of arguing in terms of free speech rights, I guess.
Yeah, and that's just a few points if I to make on these that I think are sort of worth keeping at the back of our minds. First, none of these cases, so none of these circumstances, are necessarily in rural or isolated communities where the company in question is the only service provider in town.
Mm-hmm.
So far, the smallest community where this has happened is the Washington case in the town of Richland. It's a population of about 48,000. I did a quick Google search for Richland. There are at least three other florists in town. And of course, there are other bakers in Denver, other t-shirt companies in Lexington, other photographers in Albuquerque, all of that without taking into account, you know, sort of online options. None of the services in question are anyway essential. So we're not talking sort of basic human necessities like food and shelter. There are not any basic civic rights in question. No one's being barred from the polls. Nothing's being kept off the ballot. No one's being turned away from jury duty, anything like that. In fact, I would even go a step farther and say that these are not only not essentials. Most of these services are actually luxuries of sort of the higher sort. They're things that you do if you have the money to do them, not things that you have to do to survive. All of the services in question are services that require some kind of active creation on the part of the service provider. So this is where you're talking about free speech. So it's not as if with the Kentucky t-shirt company, there were, you know, thousands of gay pride t-shirts they had in their factory that they then just refused to sell. They had to go out and create these shirts. The florist and the baker, of course, were being asked to arrange flowers and bake a cake, creating something for the wedding. If the homosexual couples in question had just walked in and bought a cake or a bouquet off the shelf, no questions would have been asked because no one would have known. Instead, there is some idea that on some level, freedom of expression, freedom of speech are in question, even if we say that's not the most important thing at the end of the day. We can't just say that doesn't count. Go ahead.
So I was just going to say, to me, the religious liberty defense is a little bit more compelling than free speech claims.
Oh, I don't disagree, but that claim is still there.
Yeah,
Particularly on the photography side of things. I don't know that much about being a florist or being a baker. I do have friends who are photographers. In their view, they are artists. Now, mm-hmm. they make a living doing that. Or they at least supplement their income doing that. But in their mind, their photographs are not just the property of the people they're taking pictures of. Their photographs are their creations.
Mm-hmm.
That needs some weight, even if...
No, I think one really distinctive thing about these cases is that the Christian baker or the Christian wedding photographer or the Christian flower arranger, they see themselves as you say, they might see themselves as artists, or they see themselves as participating in the wedding ceremony,
right?
In a very particular kind of a way.
Yeah, and that's where the religion comes in, right?
Yeah.
Because at least with the exception of the t-shirt company, the florist, the baker, the photographer, anyone who has been married or been to a wedding knows that those are integral parts of the ceremony, right? You don't have a photographer who's sort of grudgingly there, frowning the whole time and saying, this is stupid and I hate this, right? At least that wasn't our experience with our photographer. The person was encouraging, even if they didn't feel like it, even if they were just faking it. They were encouraging, and this is exciting, and this is your special day, and all of those sorts of things that suggest that the photographer, the florist, or the baker is supportive of what's going on. Mm-hmm. That's where the religious stuff comes into question.
Mm-hmm. Right? I don't think you made this point, but in many of these cases, I think in both the Oregon and the Colorado case, but at least definitely in the Colorado case, the baker made a point of saying he'd be happy to, if it were a birthday cake, he'd be happy to make them a birthday cake.
Right.
Or if they wanted to buy a stock pre-made cake without any writing on it, he'd be happy to to sell them one of those, but he just wasn't going to create a cake from scratch. Because he sees himself as an artist or a participant in this wedding ceremony that he objects to for religious reasons.
Right, and there's no religious objection, at least from sort of mainline Christianity, to birthdays. Whether you're straight or homosexual is largely irrelevant.
Right.
Everyone has a birthday,
right,
and we can all celebrate that regardless of anything else.
Mm-hmm.
There may be, is it the Jehovah's Witnesses? They don't do birthdays.
I've never been to a Jehovah's Witness birthday party.
Well,
so.
I've never been to one either, but I might be mixing them up with someone else.
I don't know that I really know many Jehovah's Witnesses.
Yeah, I don't. I know a couple of them, but I've never asked them about birthdays. Maybe I need to correct that. So that's sort of the background. That's the framework for what we're working with. Ed, anything to add to that? Anything else to add?
No, I've said my piece. So I think I know what your take is going to be on these kinds of cases, but why don't you tell us what you think of them? Or a little bit more generally of that aspect of the North Carolina law that is attempting to square out legal room for these kinds of cases of religious objection.
Yeah, I think that's a really complicated question that has sort of multiple levels of answers involved with it. That has to start with the fact that I don't really have a dog in that fight. I am in a personal sense, right? So I'm a professor at a small private Christian college. This is an issue we talk about in the classroom. The direct result of this will not immediately affect me, right? It won't affect the students who come here. It won't affect, my practices in the classroom. It doesn't change the way the electoral college works or anything like that. So it doesn't shape the way I do things. So anything I say is automatically going to be somewhat detached from this. And I think that it doesn't make my answer meaningless. It does mean that I don't have the passion that some of the people who are directly involved do have.
Mm-hmm.
So there needs to be the recognition that there are sort of real emotions involved on both sides, right? If you are a homosexual couple who are getting married, I don't think we can deny that there are some powerful passions involved there. And to have someone come along and say that what you're doing is wrong, I understand where there's going to be resistance to that. So there does need to be some empathy on that side. On the other side, if I'm a small business owner and I have the stuff that I believe religiously, I'm also going to care about that quite a bit, especially if I'm a small business owner and the government finds me out of existence. You know, that is going to be a difficult thing as well. So that has to be kept in mind, I think, as just sort of a caveat at the beginning. Couple of things. I think the initial reaction, especially from Christians, was a sort of freedom of business, freedom of property, sort of free market response. Shouldn't these people be able to refuse service to anyone? Isn't that kind of the default setting? I really wish Christians would stop using that as their default response for a couple of reasons. First, it's a loser politically. We have not had that kind of free market economics in this country since the 1930s. So if you're hanging your hat on that, you're going to lose. So just very pragmatically, it's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
But also, as a Christian, I think it's sort of a losing argument on kind of the philosophical and theological level as well. So as Christians, we don't or we shouldn't believe that we have the right to do whatever we want with our businesses. Mm-hmm. That should never be our default approach. If a compelling biblical case is made that Christians ought to be photographing homosexual weddings or baking cakes for them or whatever, then we don't get to play the "I own my own business" card and do whatever I can do whatever I want with it. Really, the "I can do whatever I want" should never be in the Christian's deck of cards to begin with, because that's not what our lives look like. It's not what they should look like. So that's one thing to remember. So when Christians are in positions of authority in businesses, we have to speak in terms of obedience and serving God, not sort of exercising our own wills by means of our corporations. Now, with that said, I think the truth probably goes the other way. I think you can make a better case from Scripture that maybe you shouldn't be working at homosexual weddings. I also think there's probably room for believers' freedom there. So I think there are ways you could use your business at a homosexual wedding without sinning. I also think you can, in good conscience, say, I can't do this, so I'm going to have to withdraw.
Right. There are certain things that we both agree that no Christian could do.
Sure.
So you couldn't be a Christian assassin, for example.
Right.
And there are certain things that Christians are going to have discretion over. So you would count this kind of thing as being in that latter category.
Yeah, well, with certain caveats. So again, if I don't think a Christian can sort of openly celebrate, like kind of directly, actively celebrate a homosexual wedding in good conscience, I think that would be beyond the pale of what the Bible allows. Now, that's not to say that if the law requires it, you could not participate in it. I just think there needs to be some clear way to say, hey, this is not okay. So, you know, if you're, how does that look on the ground? Well, I don't know. I'm not a baker. And maybe it's not possible, right? Maybe it is just actually not possible for a Christian baker to bake a cake for a homosexual wedding and not have that be seen as support.
If some friends of yours who were gay got married, would you not go to the wedding?
You know, I don't know. I have friends, I have family members who are homosexual, and that issue has not come up yet, just sort of by luck of the draw, I think. Possibly because they have not invited me, which, fine, they it's their wedding, they have the right to do that. I honestly don't know what the answer is. What about you, Ed? Which way would you go on that?
I don't know. I don't know that it's not obvious to me that going to a wedding would involve a kind of a celebration of their union in a way which defies, you know, religious conscience. But I don't know. I don't think I've been invited.
And it's obviously different if you are just an attendee, right? That is a different level of participation than if you're one of the people who's making it happen.
Or one of the people who are actually getting married to somebody of the same gender.
Well, right. So at that point, yeah, there I think we're on much clearer biblical grounds, right?
That was a joke.
Yeah.
You know, sarcasm doesn't translate as well, like, on Facebook or in podcast recordings.
No, it doesn't.
I make, like, the most sarcastic comments on Facebook, and people will be like, really? And then I'll have to write back and be like, no, not really. Anyway, sorry.
It's easier if you're just only sarcastic, right? Then that does translate much better, which I find useful for social media.
Yeah, but I could say, like, the most outrageous things, like, I ate babies this morning. And people would be like, really? That's horrible. I'd be like, no, actually, I was joking. Oh, okay. Anyways, sorry. Please continue.
Sure. Yeah, so all of that to say, I don't know what I would do if I were in that situation. It may be the case that we are moving in a direction where Christians cannot in good conscience own those sorts of businesses, right? I mean, maybe the conclusion is Christians don't get to be photographers or bakers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I don't have a direct answer to that. That is not what I would prefer to happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think I would say that it's necessarily surprising if it does. Anything to add? Any pushback on any of that, Ed?
No. But so just to get to the core of your position, I mean, you've sort of been very subtle in distinguishing between very different things. But you do think that as a matter of justice, Christians shouldn't be forced to engage in such actions for reasons of religious liberty.
Oh, absolutely. Like, as long as we have a First Amendment, right, as long as the governing law of the land says that your religious conscience is to be respected, then, yeah, absolutely. Of course they should not be forced to. That does not mean that governing law of the land will always be respected.
Mm-hmm.
I think these cases that we've seen are pretty clear, direct violations of the First Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
The government has largely seen fit not to enforce the First Amendment. So that may just mean that practically we're at a point where Christians kind of have to say, well, we cannot in good conscience engage in this because we're going to be forced to do things that we don't want
mm-hmm.
to do. So mm-hmm. we'll find something else to do. I would rather it not be that way. That is something that I would really, really not like to be the case, but that's where we're at. So
mm-hmm.
I pity the people who are in that position where they have to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
What do you got, Ed?
Yeah, so, you know, my own view is a little complicated as well. And to be honest, there are certain things that I'm still kind of thinking through. I mean, one of the good things about these last two episodes is sort of forced me to think in more concerted ways and figure out what bullets that I want to bite. But to begin with, I think it's important to distinguish between a few different questions, and it's easy for these questions to sort of get confused. So I think the theological issue of same-sex relationships is one thing, right? And as I said last week, I take a traditionalist views on matters of sexuality. I think that same-sex relationships aren't ideal. I think they're an example of the kind of brokenness that we experience in the world. Richard Hayes, the New Testament scholar at Duke, has a great chapter on these issues in his big book, The Moral Vision of the New Testament. That's a really stupendous book, I think, in outlining a way of doing moral theology. It's really cool. I don't know if you know that book, but like the first half is trying to come up with a method of doing theological ethics that's rooted in Scripture and sort of thinking about how to approach and make use of Scripture.
Sorry, what was the name of the book again?
The Moral Vision of the New Testament. I think it was written in the late 90s. It's one of the great books in New Testament ethics written in the last 20 years. I don't know. So like the first book is method. Sorry, the first half of the book is method. The second half of the book is sort of, now that we've generated this method of doing religious ethics, Christian ethics, let's apply it to a series of contemporary problems. So he talks about abortion. He talks about divorce. He talks about homosexuality. Really, really great, thoughtful chapters. His chapter on homosexuality is the best thing I've seen written defending the traditional view on sexuality. So in a really sort of sensitive, balanced way. So, I mean, I commend that to people. That's the best thing I've read on it. I think it's basically right. But sort of addressing those theological issues is distinct from a number of different questions. I do think that a lot of Christians tend to accord the question of homosexuality like greater moral significance than maybe we ought to. But anyway, so there's the theological issue, right? And then distinct from that is what you could call the pastoral or church polity related issue of how a church chooses to engage gay persons in the community, right? So what you think about the theology of same-sex relationships is different from the question of whether or not you would allow a gay pastor or a gay bishop as a part of your church, or how you welcome gay persons into membership in your community. I mean, obviously, those questions are going to be informed by how you approach the theological issue, but they're importantly distinct from it. And I think a lot more complicated.
Well, and especially complicated because at least in our country, pastors also act as agents of the state, right? When they perform weddings.
Yeah, though, I mean, we talked about that a bit last time. So they can, but that's a pretty limited function.
It is, but a pastor has the right to sign a state wedding license.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the case in every state, but at least in all of the states I've ever lived in, that has been the case. So what...
All the times you've gotten married,
all the times I've gotten married. When I got married, my pastor was English. The guy who performed our wedding ceremony was a British citizen, mm-hmm. which raised sort of interesting questions. Fortunately, he'd lived in the States long enough that his name was still on the register of pastor,
yep.
So it wasn't an issue. But yep. it did sort of point in an interesting direction of, you know, what about this guy who's a pastor from another country? But yeah, that does sort of raise the question of, this guy is allowed to perform marriages. Is he allowed to not perform a marriage if he thinks it's mm-hmm. objectionable?
Mm-hmm.
Even though he is a civil servant in that very small and limited way, is he allowed to say no, or is he basically the religious version of Kim Davis and now he needs to go to jail?
Yeah. So that's that can certainly be a matter of some significance. That in some ways falls into like one of my later categories, but yeah, certainly pastors play this particular role in these particular kinds of cases as official agents of the state so that people can perform this, you know, legal change in their status as persons. But anyways, so that, you know, the theological issues on the one hand, there are pastoral or church polity related issues on the other. There are political issues of whether gay persons should be able to get married.
Right.
To me, even though I'm sort of conservative on that first theological question, I can't think of any good reasons why, as a matter of justice and a matter of equal treatment, gay persons shouldn't be able to get married, right? I might not think that that's ideal. If I were a pastor, I might not want to actually perform those kinds of weddings, but I can't think of a good reason as a matter of justice or equality why gay persons shouldn't be able to get married. That's a third kind of a question that's distinct from these other things. A fourth kind of question is discrimination against LGBTQ persons for non-religious reasons. So should people be able to discriminate against such persons just because they don't like them? That's a fourth kind of an issue, right? So if I own a restaurant, say, and I just don't want to serve gay persons just because I don't like them, that's a fourth kind of an issue that's distinct from all of those. And I can't think of any good reasons why people as a matter, why the state should tolerate that kind of straightforward discrimination. That's a fourth kind of a claim. And then we get to the thing that we're talking about, which is discrimination against LGBTQ persons for reasons of religious conscience. And I think that's a very distinct kind of a thing. I think rights of religious liberty are among the most central rights that we have, since they get to the heart of our autonomy as persons to live and pursue our own conceptions of the good in unfettered ways. You know, so for those reasons, I think they're really central. And it's not to say that I think that there aren't going to be kinds of cases in which reasons of religious conscience aren't going to get trumped by other kinds of considerations. So, for example, I don't think that you should be able to refuse treatment for a child of yours, say, on grounds of religious conscience when medical treatments are going to be life-saving, right? So it's not as if I think that rights of religious liberty can't be trumped by other kinds of considerations. I do think they're really, really central and important, but that doesn't mean they always win. You know, you can't do just anything. You can't abuse your children for reasons of religious conscience. Those, you know, there might be real matters of religious conscience in such cases, but I would say they get trumped by concerns for the, you know, welfare and life of the children in question. But in this particular case, and you were making this point in part in your description of a lot of these cases, I think that matters of religious conscience are real. As we said earlier, florists, bakers, photographers, they often see themselves as artists, and or they often see themselves as active participants. I mean, obviously less active than the pastor in such cases, but active participants in these things. They see their efforts as they see themselves as participating in blessing such unions. I think for such people, not that every Christian baker thinks of himself or herself that way, but they well might. And if they do, for matters of religious conscience, I could see why they would want to participate in such things. And again, for a Christian baker, that's different than baking a birthday cake, say. So if a gay couple comes in wanting to buy a birthday cake, and it's really clear that it's a birthday cake for a gay person's spouse, for example, I don't think that matters of religious conscience would justify them in failing to provide that service.
Yeah, again, I would with the provision that if that person is a part of a religion that thinks that birthdays are immoral. So it's not just they won't bake it for the homosexual couple, but they think all birthdays are immoral. I don't know that I'd have an objection to that.
I guess.
I mean, yeah. You might want to have a law that says you have to post that and say, you know, hey, but even that, I mean, even that's getting into an area that I'm not terribly comfortable
with. So they're just, we don't make birthday cakes.
Yeah, so if their just rule is birthdays are sinful and we don't do that, then yeah, I'm happy to defer to religious conscience. I think I'd be comfortable with that.
What if you think cupcakes are sinful? So you'd be willing to provide a cake for a birthday party or even a gay wedding, but never cupcakes.
Yeah, again, that's fine. I would want to see the verse they're drawing that from out of scripture, but
I definitely think cupcakes are immoral.
Yeah.
I'm a full cake.
Only in large quantities.
Don't come to my party bearing cupcakes.
So you're not one of those like boutique cupcake place goers?
I have been known to eat them on occasion, but I do believe in cake.
I think it's immoral to pay like $5 for a cupcake. Like it's not that those, you know, the fancy cupcakes don't taste good. It's just the prices are so outrageous.
It's true.
That
there's typically too much icing too, I think. But Anyways, once again, we digress from the issue at hand. So, you know, that issue of discrimination against LGBTQ persons for reasons of religious conscience, I think, is distinct.
Well, let's challenge the phrasing there a little bit, though. So even by saying it that way.
Yeah, I know.
The other way to say it is, and you know, that's how one side of the argument portrays it.
Yeah.
The other way is to say that, you know, Christians have refused to use their businesses as a means of publicly celebrating sin, even when ordered to do so by the government. So even how you phrase that.
Yeah, I know. Sort of I understand that. Yeah. So I think that Christian bakers can refuse service to LGBTQ persons for reasons of religious conscience in ways that are justifiable. The one thing that I would want to note is that, like, one of the reasons why I think it's justifiable is that these cases are, like, they're really narrow. One of the reasons why they're narrow is the particular connection that these people see to the performance of a religious rite on the one hand. That's one reason why they're narrow. The very kind of incidents is very narrow. So we're talking about wedding cakes. We're not talking about restaurants or employment or bathrooms. You know, we aren't talking about things that are more ubiquitous to human life or things that are more central to human life, like employment. So again, I think reasons of religious conscience can sometimes get trumped. But one of the things that I think are distinct about these kinds of cases is that they're relatively narrow in this way, both in the way that they arise as matters of religious conscience for some kinds of people, and both because they describe like a very specialized aspect of human life. So maybe you and I don't disagree on that specific issue.
Yeah, and again, I think most of our whatever disagreement we have is going to come in phrasing. So I would say these cases, I'm on the side I'm on, not because they're narrow, but because they're so broad. I mean, the First Amendment is intended to protect freedom of religion, not just in the narrow sense, but in the broad and public sense. The idea is not that you can have your religion as long as you're at home with the doors shut and locked and the window shades pulled. It's you can engage, you can live your religion in the public square. Including businesses, including in government. So you said that there's a difference between the question, you know, the theological issue of same-sex marriage and the political issue of same-sex marriage. And I agree, but because of the nature of the country we live in, my opinion about what the political status of gay marriage should be is just as valid as someone who's on the other side. So I get to push for my issue and they get to push for theirs. And one of us is going to win and one of us is going to lose, and that's fine. But if I say, you know, because I think homosexuality is wrong and gay marriage is not actually marriage at all, I'm allowed to try to bring that into the law. I'm allowed to try to influence the way the law grows through things like voting, through things like engaging in the electoral process and so on. So I wouldn't say that this issue matters because it's narrow. I'd say this issue matters because it's sort of striking at the heart of the point behind religious freedom. From a political sense, not theological.
So I agree. I mean, I agree with a lot of what you say. Maybe working out that disagreement might be interesting. So I think one reason why progressives who otherwise value religious liberties or liberties of conscience, for what it's worth, do you draw a distinction between those two things?
Same,
religious liberty and liberties of conscience?
religious liberty and liberty of conscience.
Some people like to draw a distinction between those two things. To me, they just amount to the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, so, you can have people who are not religious. So I suppose in that sense, like, you have an atheist who believes certain things are right or wrong.
Yeah.
I guess I would say the language there is going to be liberty of conscience, because religious liberty in his view is going to be nothing. But if you want to just say from our perspective, that's still, he's still exercising a kind of religion, I guess I wouldn't have a problem with that.
Yeah, that's what I meant. I mean, so I would say that religious liberties are just a specific species of liberties of conscience.
Right. So there are things that I think are right and wrong that are not necessarily tied to my religion. So yeah. I have thoughts about gun ownership, but I don't tie that to my faith. Like, those are just things that I think because of the culture I live in and so on. Yeah. So, yeah, I'd say there's a difference there, but I have not sat down and kind of thought through what that actually means.
Uh-huh.
You've thought more about this than I have, so.
Well, maybe only a little bit more. But anyway, so we can use those terms interchangeably.
Sure.
And I think one of the reasons why liberals who otherwise care about First Amendment rights are less sensitive to these issues of religious liberty is because I think they sort of tend to think of religion as being a very private kind of a thing, right?
Right.
So it's what you do in your home. It's what you do on Sundays. It just doesn't, but it just has nothing to do with the public world. And as a result, when Christians try to make it a matter of the public world, I think that just looks like attempts to discriminate against other people in the public square. But I think that's just because they sort of think of religion in this particular kind of a way. So to me, I mean, it'll be kind of interesting when these cases wend their way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court, that's one of the reasons why I think all of these cases are particularly interesting. Like, you know, so you go to the, in which the liberal justices, you know, should be exercised or are exercised by matters of freedom of conscience. But, you know, are sort of forced to balance out those kinds of considerations against other kinds of considerations.
Yeah, you know, honestly, I wouldn't try to predict which way the court, as it currently exists, would go. You know, especially with Scalia gone. Scalia, and we will get angry notes about this. Scalia was a phenomenal judge in many ways. Freedom of religion was not really his strong suit. Like, he could be a little wishy-washy on that at times. Mm-hmm. That is my one criticism of Scalia. And
yeah, of course, you know,
the only thing I've said about in this episode. Scalia is a phenomenal judge, but that's sort of the place where I'd say, yeah. And because he's gone, I don't know where they would come, where they would fall on that issue.
Yeah. So one interesting thing about Scalia. Scalia wrote the majority opinion in a case in the early 90s involving the religious use of peyote.
He did. That's
so
true.
And so he ruled against religious freedom in that case.
He did.
Right? So there are these two employees. I can't remember how they, maybe there's a drug test or something like that. But they lost their jobs and they actually lost their pensions. They were state employees. Their pension benefits. And so they sued. And Scalia ruled in favor of the defendants. And his point was that, like, these religious liberties would allow too much power to individuals just to trump, you know, laws that are passed that are, what's the phrase, like, general and neutral in their application. So his point was that the state of Oregon had a real compelling interest that was general and neutral in character in prohibiting the use of psychedelic drugs.
Right. Well, and they were state employees, too. So it's mm-hmm. There was some narrowness in that decision. It's been a while since I've looked at it, but
I don't know that particular fact mattered in the opinion that he wrote. But anyway, so he ruled in favor of the state to pass laws that sort of in some ways bump up against people's religious liberties.
Right.
So that was kind of interesting. You know, here you have this conservative justice making a ruling sort of against a strong view of religious liberties. But here's the thing, like, that law was what led the federal government in 1993 to pass the what was the name of the law? But it's the law that's at the heart of all of these new
the Religious Freedom Restoration Act.
Yeah, exactly. Which sort of mandated that states apply the rule of strict scrutiny in in these kinds of cases, right? So strict scrutiny is the really high bar that states need to cross in order to justify restrictions on people's religious liberties.
Right. Which and is the Supreme test... Court then overturned that act. So
how do you mean?
So the court overturned, what was the name of the case? It was like City of something or other versus Flores. They didn't overturn the whole act, but they overturned the parts of it that were relevant to the peyote case. Congress then passed another. I mean, there as with so many things, there's kind of a back and forth.
But,
I have no
but
idea
my
where
point
right
is
now.
That like, you know, there was this legislative response to Scalia's ruling.
Right.
That's getting applied in these cases now, right? So in the Hobby Lobby case and in the Little Sisters of Mercy cases, you know, the test was strict scrutiny as arose from this previous law. And strict scrutiny means, oh, what's the language? In order to be justifiable, a state law that might impinge on people's religious liberties, there has to be a compelling state interest. That's one thing.
Right. So the law cannot attack, I think the phrase is discrete and insular minorities.
Yeah.
That is people who cannot defend themselves otherwise.
Yeah.
If they come under attack, then the Supreme Court is going to step in and really pay close attention to the language of the law and make sure that the state's not up to anything that would be unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that they're going to automatically overturn the law. That they're going to pay a lot of attention to it.
Well, yeah, that's right. And the state just can't pass a law that isn't motivated by a compelling public interest, right? So if the state just wanted to restrict people's religious liberties from some small religious minority just because they don't like them, right? Can't do that. There has to be a legitimate, compelling state interest that is motivating the state's concern. And then the second thing is that law has to be the narrowest way of addressing that particular compelling state interest. Right, and so it was that latter clause that was so much in play in the Little Sisters of Mercy's case, because there's a question about whether the federal government's attempt to respect the religious liberties of the nuns in that case, along with address people's ability to get birth control, whether they were pursuing that in like the most narrow way.
Yeah, have you read that opinion or listened to the arguments there yet?
I haven't sat down and read the text of the opinion, but I think I'm relatively familiar with the legal issue.
So is my feel on that case is that the court honestly doesn't understand sort of the mechanics of the law in question. Is it like, was that the sense you got from it?
I mean, no.
You have this odd circumstance where they actually ask for another brief after they've already had the hearing. And I mean, you can count on one hand the number of times the Supreme Court has actually done that. They ask for clarification after the oral arguments.
Yeah.
So that,
yeah, because so much
is they just don't know what's going on, so they kick back to the...
Yeah. Yeah, and so what they ruled most recently, well, they didn't rule, right?
They deferred back to the lower courts.
But a lot of it just had to do with the nature of the compromise.
Right.
So, you know, the Affordable Care Act had exemptions built into it from the get-go for churches.
Right.
And for charitable organizations like the Little Sisters of Mercy. But the way that exemption worked, so there was an exemption for churches, which was more or less just a, this doesn't apply to you. The exemption for religious charitable organizations was, you don't have to cover this in your health insurance plans, but you need to sign a document telling your insurer that you don't want them to cover this, and then the federal government would require the insurer to cover it anyway. That was the compromise that they issued.
Right. So there's
the
still
Little Sisters
some
of Mercy,
paying for it on the part of the employer. Like there's still some sort of
insurance company was going to pick up the tab, right?
Well, right. I mean, as much as they actually would pick up the tab.
Well, the federal government was going to say, you have to cover this and you're going to have to pick up the tab.
Right.
And in many ways, it's in the interest of insurance companies to pick up the tab because paying for birth control is cheaper than paying for a delivery or an abortion for that matter, right? So in some ways, they have financial incentives for wanting to cover this. But the idea was the charitable organization isn't going to pay for it. You're going to pay for it. But then the Little Sisters of Mercy came back and said, no, that's not providing us enough coverage. We don't even want to sign the document because we see that as kicking off this process, which is going to get this thing covered. So a lot of it sort of turned on like, I mean, really sort of minute issues about the extent to which the Little Sisters of Mercy understood themselves to be implicated in the provision of birth control, right? And so they weren't paying for it. That was really clear. But they were like, we don't want to even fill out the form. And then I think the compromise that they issued was, okay, fine. You have to notify your insurer that you don't want it covered. And then the federal government is going to pay for it, is actually going to pay for it. And I think that that was the compromise that the Supreme Court brokered.
In an earlier case. Right, that had, you know, maybe...
I think it was in earlier iterations of this conflict.
Right.
And then they threw it back down to the lower courts to sort of make, to get everybody sort of officially sign on to it. But that was the compromise that they brokered. And I can't even remember how we got to this particular topic. Oh, it was on this offhand remark that you made about Scalia.
But it does still tie in because it's... You still, even aside from the deal and aside from the result of this decision, you still have the question of whether a religious organization like the Little Sisters of the Poor, if their rule is that our employees are not allowed to use birth control because we are a Catholic organization, mm-hmm. Is the government allowed to step in and say, well, we're going to make sure that your employees have birth control anyway? That sort of points us back to this question of kind of the dealing with stuff that you think is religiously unconscionable. Mm-hmm. How far can the government compel you to go along with that before the First Amendment has been violated? Mm-hmm. Like at what point have we crossed the line and violated our own law, our own really fundamental right as Americans? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. And I'm sorry, I'm trying to chase back to the point of departure for all of this. I was agreeing with everything that you were saying, but then I wanted to draw a kind of a distinction. So I was making this point about the Supreme Court, and then I think I said earlier, progressives really should care about First Amendment rights and freedoms of conscience and freedoms of religious liberties.
I agree that they should. I regret
and then
that they usually
be, and, oh, and then my point was that it's going to be interesting to see what they do. So, like in the Hobby Lobby case, for example, one of the point of disagreement for the progressive justices wasn't that this was a matter of religious liberties. It had to do with whether corporations had rights of religious liberties.
Right.
Right. So it wasn't sort of it wasn't about religious. It wasn't about the scope of religious liberties. It was about whether closely held corporations had them. And so that was the reason for rejecting them. And then you go back and you look at the case of this New Mexico wedding photographer. You know, the court didn't even hear it, which is kind of interesting because I guess even the conservatives didn't want to hear the case. And they had a majority at that point. But anyways, but, you know, that case was pitched as a freedom of speech issue. So it'll be interesting to see. To me, to see what the court does when these cases bubble up all the way to the top and they're presented as what I think they are, issues of religious liberty. And we'll see what happens. And certainly lower courts have typically ruled against the Christians in these kinds of cases.
Depending on where you are. I mean, that...
Yeah, well, that's true.
That's
but
so depends
in Oregon
on what
and Colorado...
Circuit.
And New Mexico,
right?
Anyways,
right. But and of course we wouldn't hear as much about the cases where they rule in favor of the, because they don't make the news. That's not,
yeah.
Like court upholds a liberty that's been upheld for 200 years isn't news, right? That's mm-hmm. that's just sort of day to day life. These things make the news because they are different and new, mm-hmm. and a shift in our law. Mm-hmm.
But you know, when these cases finally make it to the court, it'll be interesting to see what they do. I think progressives should say, yeah, this is a matter of religious liberty. We're going to rule for the defendant. And, you know, I don't know if I want to go out on the limb and predict that they will. For all the reasons that I'm talking about, they're relatively, these particular cases are relatively narrow in their effect. And so I think that'll make them all the more willing to draw exceptions. Oh, but this is the point that I wanted to disagree with you. You were sort of making this point about how they're actually not narrow. They're really, really broad. And I kind of see your point. And that was kind of what I was getting at when I said that progressives often see religion as being a private matter, and they're wrong about that. It's a very public matter. But I also think that you think that religious liberties protect people in a broader variety of cases than I do. And that might be a source of disagreement between you and me.
I mean, it might be. I do tend to want to give kind of maximum deference to freedom of religion whenever possible. Like, there is a line where freedom of religion, like, you shouldn't cross, but I think that line should be sort of, when we're talking federal government stuff, mm-hmm. So which of course is all what we're talking about, in terms of just the direct state application, well, that's really not the conversation that our culture's having right now. No one's really asking, should organ bakers, bakers who live in Oregon have to bake cakes for mm-hmm. homosexual weddings. We're all asking, mm-hmm. should this be the law of the land?
Yeah. Well, and then, yeah, so that kind of federalism really matters to you. I mean, I guess I would say that, like, whenever you're talking about a case of rights, it's immediately going to jump out of the state context and go to the federal. Because the question is, is there a right? And if there's a right, then it's a right that everyone has.
Right. So if someone wants to come along and make the sort of radical originalist argument that says the First Amendment begins with the word Congress and therefore only applies to the national government and states can do whatever they want, I will happily cheer that argument. That is an application that I think is the original intent of the amendment and the way it ought to work. But that's not the world we live in anymore. Again, we have nationalized all of this to the point where that's just where we have to go.
So you think that if a state wanted to continue to discriminate against black people, the Constitution tolerates that?
Depending on your interpretation of the 14th Amendment, and I guess the Civil War amendments, we'd have to say, depending on how you read that, I think those are broadly written enough amendments that you could legitimately say, no, the intent here was to kind of eliminate that racial distinction, especially given the people who wrote them. I think there is a good originalist argument to be made that, yeah, those amendments were not just to end slavery. They were also to begin the integration of African Americans into overall society. And that's certainly the application we see during Reconstruction when kind of mm-hmm. radical Republicans were at the helm.
Mm-hmm. But before those amendments.
Well,
so say in
before those in, amendments, we lived, I mean, those amendments were added. Like, were those amendments good things or bad things? Well, I think they were generally good things, even if they've been used badly at times. I think you can make the case that sort of closes the door. And again, as an originalist, I think you can make the case that the Civil War amendments are intended to do in some ways what we've seen them do. I also think they have nothing to do with religion or speech or the things that the First Amendment is dealing
with. Yeah. You know, I don't know that I want to talk about constitutional interpretation today.
That's
something else that we should add to our list of things. I'm not an originalist. I would describe myself as a principalist, but anyways.
Right.
But setting aside those issues of federalism, let's just talk about state laws then. If a state wanted to pass a law, let's just talk about the state. If I were a Christian white supremacist, and I didn't want to serve black people in my restaurant, is that a matter of religious?
Well, so we've got to start with the principle that even white supremacists have rights.
Yeah.
So as with, I think the direction I would go is, as with the baker, for the homosexuals. You know, if someone comes in to the store and wants to buy a cake off the rack, then you serve them, right? I mean, that's sort of what we both agreed on earlier. I think probably the same thing applies to if you are a white supremacist baker and someone comes in and wants to buy a cake off the rack, assuming you have religious motivations for this. Mm-hmm. Someone wants to buy a cake off the rack, you sell them the cake off the rack. If someone comes in and says, hey, I want you to bake me a cake for my, you know, Black Panthers get together, or vice versa, you know, if you're a black supremacist and a member of the local Klan chapter comes in, do you have to bake them a cake? Well, I think if you have religious objections, even if I think the reasons that you have are sort of morally reprehensible, you have rights too. The fact that I disagree with you does not mean you don't have rights. In fact, the fact that I disagree with you makes it more important that you have rights. That's the point of rights in the first place.
Yeah.
So what do you think, Ed? I mean, if you're a Jewish baker, and a Muslim comes into your store and says, I want you to bake me a cake for my Allah Hates Israel party. Do you have to bake that?
You know, so I would say that what makes that a different kind of a case is that it's specifically asking you to sort of write or endorse a view that for matters of conscience you find reprehensible. So, like, the point about, so this is a way in which, like, these kinds of cases, I think, are narrow, right? So for a t-shirt maker who is asked to sort of provide shirts and write slogans that they find reprehensible, or a cake baker, those, I think, are sort of distinct and narrow precisely because of their nature. But that's different to me than a restaurateur. So let's say you were Jewish and you owned a deli, and a Muslim person walks in, and they walk in, and you say, "Hey, we don't serve your kind here." And I say, "Why?" And I say, "Well, for religious reasons." That I think doesn't fly.
Well, if you're Jewish and you own a deli, and a Christian comes in and says, "You know, I want a bacon sandwich,"
well,
you have to serve me.
Well, I mean, not if you don't serve bacon sandwiches.
To anyone.
Right? So the idea, okay. I mean, the idea is that you can't treat one person differently than another,
right.
Not that you have to provide whatever I ask you to.
Yeah, again, I would agree with that by and large. There is a part of me that leans in the libertarian direction and wants to say, no, it's your business, and if you don't want to serve people, you don't have to. But again, just pragmatically, that's not the world we live in. And that is not a good sort of Christian theological argument in any case. Again, I think maximum deference to the religious conscience. So if you're a deli owner, a Jewish deli owner, you don't have to cater the Palestinian, you know, party, or vice versa. If you're a Palestinian deli owner, you don't have to cater the pro-Israel party. It's just if there is a religious reason for it, I'm happy to say, yeah, go find another deli.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So one thing that struck me in our last conversation, as you say, like, your view sort of seemed like libertarian. It really did seem libertarian.
When it comes to religious freedom, again, especially at the national level, yeah, I'm absolutely going to lean libertarian. You start getting kind of closer and closer to the state level, the local level. Okay, I'm willing to talk about that a little bit, but that's not the conversation the culture is having, so we don't have to go there. That's nationally, absolutely.
But if a state wanted to pass a law allowing, well, discriminating against persons for religious reasons?
Or allowing to say that differently, allowing people to live according to their religious conscience.
Yeah.
I think I'm largely okay with that.
Well, that's...
But again, that's not the conversation that we're having culturally. It's what should we do nationally? Because that's just not the world we live in. I hate to keep repeating that, but now these decisions are all national. So
yeah,
that's the conversation we have to have.
So if I were a white supremacist, a Christian white supremacist, and I owned a factory and I didn't want to hire black people.
For religious reasons.
For religious reasons.
Right. And assuming that you can actually show that these are religious reasons.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Member I mean, of a church, that that's kind of the formal teaching.
Yes.
Yeah, so I mean, what do you do? Would you compel them to hire the African American?
Yeah, I would compel them. That's a no-brainer.
And again, the you would say the radical Zionist who owns a factory has to hire the fundamentalist Muslim when they show up.
Yes. Yes,
so
I would.
So you're sort of willing to apply that across the board.
You know, I think in some ways the white supremacist case is better.
Well, yeah, because... it leans more in your direction, so of course.
Well, no. Better in the sense that it's not just that they dislike black people. It's that they think for principled reasons we shouldn't mix it all.
Right.
Whereas in the Jewish case, it's not like that. So, I mean, you know, you can be very you can be Jewish and very pro-Israel and be very down on Muslim Palestinian people. But it's not like there's anything in your theology that says that, like, in principle, we shouldn't even hang out with you.
Oh, I know so little about...
Well, anyway, so that's my point. But that's fine. I'm happy to go with your example, too.
Right.
And I'll just say, no, you have to hire them.
Right. So we're sort of moving back in the direction of, do you serve someone the cake if they just walk in and want to buy something off the rack? Right. That is closer to that than do you actually celebrate? Even then, my comfort would be more... I would be more comfortable with deferring to the religious stuff if at all possible, not to countenance the morality of the beliefs, because again, we have to say, hey, they're doing this thing that I think is just terrible. What are rights for if not protecting people that do things that we think are terrible and say things that we think are terrible?
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's
yeah.
not rights. It's yeah. just we're celebrating people who agree with us, and that's no protection at all.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right, and that's important. I guess I would just say, though, that even rights sometimes bump up against other rights, and then you have to draw conclusions about how you're going to adjudicate such conflicts.
Well, maybe we should, unless you had anything else to add specifically about that.
No. So, though, I was just going to say that, like, you know, rights are symmetrical, right? And so if you're willing to tolerate that in our country, you would have to say that as a matter of justice, there is no justice in, say... And I mean, you kind of hinted at this at another time, but, you know, imagine a Christian minority living in an Islamic state that permits certain kinds of discriminations against Christians. And then you would have to say, well, as a matter of justice... as a matter of religious conscience, we can't complain against that. And then I want to say, no, you know, you can't, they can't do that either. So, you know, what's sauce for the goose is going to be sauce for the gander.
Right. So if you're assuming sort of a universal application of liberal Western rights.
Well.
Like these rights that come out of our tradition also apply to people who don't have that tradition.
I mean, to me, a right is a universal normative claim that you're making about something.
Right. And we talked about in both our liberalism and conservative episodes.
Yeah.
You're speaking a language that is in some ways meaningless to someone who doesn't come out of the Western liberal tradition. Liberal, little l.
So, I mean, I would say this. Yeah, in a way that's true. And I just said, yeah, there are certain moral realities and they're just wrong about that. You know, some people, they're just wrong. We have moral disagreements and I think that people are wrong about that.
No, I would agree that the Christian in the Muslim country ought not be persecuted. I don't know that I would make the rights argument because their response is going to be actually they don't have those rights. And my response is if I'm coming at this from someone out of the Western tradition, my response has to be, well, in our tradition, we do, and we think everyone does. But, I mean, now you're sort of taking the cultural imperialism approach that you're wrong for not adopting my culture.
Well, I would say you're wrong for not recognizing this moral reality. So you often distinguish between legal rights and moral rights. And I understand that legal rights are one thing and moral rights are the other. But I think they're moral rights. I mean, you think they're moral rights too, but
Yeah, and again, I just want to use different language, but that's a different conversation. Anything else to add there? Otherwise, I'm going to end with or bring up your question, I think.
Oh, sure. Well, go ahead.
So the question that you asked in the show notes, and I thought it was a better question to ask for you than for me, because I'm sure my opinion has been stated. Is it in fact wrong for a Christian to participate in a same-sex wedding? And let's go ahead and say as a primary participant rather than just an attendee. So as a florist, as a baker, as a preacher, as someone who is sort of intimately involved in the goings-on at a wedding, do you think it's wrong?
Well, so I think it's complicated, you know, so it's one kind of a question about whether attending such a wedding is wrong from a Christian point of view. And the case of a pastor, I think, is even yet more complicated. It's less complicated is what I mean to say. That is sort of getting closer to participating in an event that I think for theological reasons is like not ideal. Though I wouldn't necessarily want to say that there wouldn't be some kind of rationale that would justify a pastor from doing that, but I don't know.
Right. So I would say if you can find a way to participate with charity and truth, then I think there's probably ground to do so.
Mm-hmm.
I do not necessarily see how you could participate with both of those things. Like, if you can maintain your religious conviction and do so in a way that is loving to everyone involved, then yeah, I think you could participate, but I don't see what that is.
Yeah, you know, and I think your way of putting the point is nice. And so I would say, like, given the history of the Christian church and the ways, and the really objectionable, awful ways in which it has dealt with gay persons.
Right.
That our attitude should be one of looking to try to extend as much hospitality and love to such persons as is possible, given the history.
Yeah, there's
and so, you know,
sorry, go ahead.
Given that way of putting the point, I think I could happily attend a wedding and understand my participation is, I'm not blessing there. My participation isn't meant to be like a blessing on their union, but I'm there out of my love for this person. And maybe you could say something like that. I think the case of the baker or the florist is maybe easier. I don't necessarily know that your baking a cake amounts to sort of an act of endorsement. And in the case of the pastor, you know, maybe that's less straightforward, but maybe there's a kind of a story that the pastor could, a justification that was available such that maybe this isn't the case. Maybe it's not.
Yeah, again,
but in any case, I think our attitude should be. I don't think we disagree about that. But our attitude, as you say, should be sort of one of trying to extend, given our history, maximal hospitality and love.
Yeah, there's just that really unfortunate stretch of time from the 1950s through the 1990s when, for reasons that I am not historically informed enough to know what the basis is, but for whatever reason, homosexuality sort of became the super sin,
yeah,
right there, as if somehow it's a worse sin than my gluttony or my pride or any of the other things that I struggle with.
Yeah.
And now I think that is being corrected. I think that's that we're starting to see a turn away from that in evangelical Christianity, not in the sense of saying it's not a sin, but in bringing a sort of balance in saying, look, this is a sin, but it is just another sin. It is as deserving of hell as any of the things that I struggle with. I think it may take a while before the culture sort of catches up and stops hearing that older voice, and stops sort of hearing the older condemnations. Maybe the culture will never catch up. I don't know. I don't think that changes our obligation to speak the truth, but to speak the truth in a way that is kind and gracious.
Mm-hmm.
So what that looks like on the ground at weddings, especially if you're a baker or a florist or whatever, I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and in some ways, as you say all that, I mean, if I were a baker, I mean, one thing about those cases, and who knows what actually went down when the couple walked into the, you know, the baker's shop.
Sure.
It seemed like, at least in the Colorado case, he was making a real point of saying, I'm happy, you can buy a cake, I'm happy to make you a birthday cake, you know. But it, you sort of wonder the extent to which, under those conditions, a person could have extended such maximal hospitality while still refusing to make the wedding cake itself, such that the complaint wouldn't have arisen. I mean, maybe that's impossible, but what if, you know, but I think our attitude anyway should be one of extending maximal hospitality. And
yeah, my feel for at least some of these cases is that I don't know about every circumstance, but in at least some of them, clearly someone was looking for a court case out of this. Mm-hmm. Like someone was trying to get this into the courts and get a decision. Just given the number of bakers, florists, and t-shirt companies available in each of these places, I don't see how it could have been the case that all they wanted was a wedding cake. Mm-hmm. Like if that was the end goal, that could have been accomplished without a lawsuit, mm-hmm. or without, you know, involving the government of Oregon. Certainly could have been accomplished without a $135,000 fine. So there, now that's not to say that's the case that's not to say that on the religious side, everyone is absolutely right in every circumstance. I don't know all the nuts and bolts of all of the cases. I think someone was going for precedent, trying to establish precedent. And, you know, that's fine. That's, people do that. Anything to add there, Ed?
No. Well, I think we've probably exhausted all of the things that you and I have to say about this coil. Any parting thoughts?
Yeah, again, I would say engage the issue with sort of charity whenever possible. I would also say if you are an evangelical Christian and you don't have friends or family who are homosexual, just be very cautious in how you engage it. In fact, I would say try to have friends who are homosexual, because how do you speak to the issue if you don't have personal investment in it? You know,
you're absolutely right. And there's a big difference in approaching a topic from some sort of abstract distance and approaching the topic when you're in a very intimate and familiar way. That's it.
Right. And obviously only, you know, if you're trying to make friends with someone, you can only do half of the work there. Mm-hmm. That's true in this case as well. And honestly, the individuals that you are trying to befriend will in some ways have a bigger hurdle to overcome than you will because of that historical mm-hmm. bias, right? Because of mm-hmm. the way things have gone in the past. I don't have specific how to make friends advice other than, you know, go out and start talking to people. Statistically, 4 to 6% of the people you know, be they friends mm-hmm. or family, are homosexual.
You know, it's an interesting thing as more gay and lesbian persons come out of the closet, like the extent to which there are people who just don't know about anybody who is out, you know?
Right.
Whether that's even possible anymore. I mean, I suppose it is.
I don't know. I wouldn't want to speak to that, but
yeah.
But the big point is be gracious.
I think that's something that we can all agree on. And so with that said, let me thank everyone again for spending some time with us. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. To learn more about the other podcasts or our own in that network, visit our homepage at christianhumanist.org. Please also consider leaving us a review on iTunes. We'd be really appreciative if you did that. We would also love it if you liked our Facebook page. That gives us a way to interact with our listeners, and we provide some additional content there as well. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast. You can also email us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. And until next time, do not forget to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and to render unto God those things that are God's. Thanks.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high.